Comments made on the Serotalk podcast are those of the individuals and do not represent Serotalk Corporation, its staff, management, board of directors, or third-party resellers.
Welcome to the Serotalk podcast.
Serotalk podcast.
Welcome to the Serotalk podcast, your portal to the accessible digital lifestyle.
www.serotalk.com.
A production of Serotech Corporation, creators of System Access, the System Access mobile network, and SA2Go. Learn about new technology, cool software, useful websites, education, information, entertainment, user comments, and much more. And now, here's your host, Michael Loft.
Welcome to Serotalk.
Welcome to Serotalk Podcast 61 for February 14, 2011. This is Michael Loft.
I'm Ricky Inger.
Ricky, a lot of good tech chat. So I thank our producer, Joe Steinkamp, for coming up with some really good guests. Tech Chat 89 recently with Jim Fruchterman talking about accessible books for everyone. Tech Chat 88 this month in Access Tech for January. We had some great guests, Rodney and Aaron Edgar, with Tech Access Weekly Podcast. And Tech Chat 87, which was right after ATIA, actually the last day of the event. And we talked about highlights. We had Brad Hodges with AFB. We had Dean Martineau with Top Tech Tidbits. And Larry L. Lewis with flying-blind.com talking about the first 12-cell Braille pin display for $9.99, breaking the $1,000 barrier. So a lot of good stuff there. Not to mention our own 25 interviews that I acquired in my slightly more than one day. You combine that with great interviews from blindbargains.com, and there's a lot of good information out there about ATIA 2011 if you have not heard it. All available at serotalk.com, on Samnet, and iBlink Radio.
Yeah, that's right. I actually wanted to mention something about iBlink Radio. It was quite nice for me to be able to listen to these tech chats on my phone because I wasn't home for all of them, and I could interact and submit a text question if I needed to bring the portion of the tech chat where those things are allowed, and I could do that right from the iPhone. You know, it's just an indication that we really don't have to be tied to our PCs for much of anything.
That's the key. We are going mobile, and some even say the desktop is obsolete. So, well, you've heard us talk about DocuScan Plus, but there have been two reviews put out that will let you get a little better feel for how it works. First of all, Ricky, you did a demo over at Accessible World recently.
I did, yes. The archive is available on the Accessible World Tech Talk section of the site, and I really enjoyed it, especially the Q&A section of it, because I was able to do a brief demo, but the really fun part was interacting with the audience and seeing what types of questions they had. There were some really good ones, but aside from my review, we did have a third-party reviewer, Deborah Kendrick, over at Access World, reviewed DocuScan Plus for the February issue. And it's a good read. I think Deborah really kind of condenses down to the important features of DocuScan Plus. In her review, she is using it directly from the web rather than as an installed copy on her computer. You can do both, certainly. But as you read her review, keep in mind that she is doing it from the web. You can scan when this is installed on your computer. You can use it offline if you don't have an internet connection and just save things directly to your machine. And if you do have an internet connection, you can look at all the stuff that you've stored in the cloud and certainly add to that if you like. So do check out the article in the February issue of Access World to learn a little bit more about DocuScan Plus.
Indeed. In shopping news, it looks like near-field communications is going to be a reality. We've talked about this earlier, and we found a great primer, they call it, that really goes into great detail explaining it. So I want to ask you, Ricky, I've talked to Mike and Joe about this, but would you yourself like the ability to pay for things with your iPhone or Android phone, maybe even use your phone to walk up and navigate a kiosk? That's something we talked about in Tech Chat 89, or maybe even start your car, open the garage, or there's a variety of different applications for this. How do you feel about that?
I think it has some very interesting possibilities, and in fact, they've actually adopted something very similar to this using slightly different technology in Japan. But for me, I feel like what happens if someone steals my phone? And of course, the same question could be asked, I suppose, as far as what happens if somebody steals your wallet. But to me, this really opens up some interesting possibilities, and not all of them good, for somebody to basically come in and have access to everything in your life if you happen to drop your phone somewhere or somebody snatches it from you. And then what do you do?
Or what if, you know, your data somehow is intercepted?
Exactly.
And speaking of interception and identity theft and all that interesting stuff, the actual number of victims in 2010 dropped down to 8.1 million. Still a pretty hefty number, but down from 11 million in 2009. Some very interesting statistics there, because it looks like in 2009 you had 56 million people involved. In 2010, it dropped to 37 million. And while the fraud declined, it was interesting that the out-of-pocket costs of those who were victimized increased, mainly due to the types of fraud. And this is the one that concerns me. It's what's called friendly fraud. I hadn't heard that term before, but what they're talking about, and this is something I learned firsthand with the Better Business Bureau, that a lot of theft comes from family members and friends, and maybe in-home health workers and friends of your kids and things of that sort. So that is very significant when you think about it. And I saw instances where parents would use their children's social security numbers to open up accounts. And that's what the new fraud is. While fraud is down, the new ones are very disconcerting, because what happened is people are opening new accounts in your name, but of course the bills are going to a different address. So it could be quite some time before you find out about it. You can do cell phone, cable, TV, and different accounts like that. So it's a little disconcerting, and just a reminder
Absolutely.
That we still need to be on our guard.
Yeah, got to be careful, even with people that you believe you trust. Be careful about just how much information you share.
Looks like U.S. Representative Edward Markey has asked the FTC, Federal Trade Commission, to look into in-app purchases, in particular games, iOS devices, also Android, but right now primarily iOS, is the most common portal, because they're targeting kids. And what's happening is they can buy things inside these games, and parents are hit with these unexpected bills. And, you know, when I had my credit card stolen, that's exactly what happened, is they were using it to buy items within World of Warcraft. So the best advice in the short term is to simply turn off the capability by going into settings, general, and restrictions. That's, of course, under iPhone. So check that out. We don't want our kids racking up high bills for us at all. European publishers are also upset with in-app subscriptions. So we'll be hearing a lot more about that in the future.
I think they're rightly upset about this kind of thing, because what Apple wants to do, they want to get a cut of this money. And so they are attempting to do something such that people will purchase subscriptions through Apple. And of course, Apple is going to retain some of the data about the people who do this. And this is the type of thing that would normally go to the publishers themselves. And that sort of drives what the publishers do. They need to know who their readership is. They need to get that sort of data. But Apple may clench its fist pretty tightly on that stuff and just give the publishers what Apple deems important.
Well, we've also saw in the new terms of service the ability to do auto renewal. So there's a lot of concern about that. And I'm not a big fan of auto renewal. That's my consumer advocate coming out. So that will make a little bit of a headache for Apple. There will be more, obviously, credit card and debit card disputes that result. So I'd be curious to see what happens with that. The NFB Blind Driver Challenge is something that kind of we didn't cover that much, because, you know, we did all of our coverage the last podcast on ATIA. So I want to ask you about this, Ricky. This took place on the 29th. Mark Riccobono drove around a track there in Daytona, Florida, 3.5-mile track. Blind Bargains was there. You can listen to their coverage of it. There was also a press conference and an actual audio broadcast of the event as it took place live, although you couldn't hear the vehicle and things of that sort. So he had to maneuver around boxes and drive beside a van. So they did show that there was a little bit to this event, but I'm just curious on your thought. Did it impress you any? I mean, I have to say it was good. They had a plan and everything seemed to execute as they had planned.
Yeah, well, except for the quality of the audio stream itself. And even if you listen to the press conference, you're going to want to have your volume knob handy because it is a bit loud and distorted. But what I find interesting about this is that it's really a hot button for a lot of people. You know, there are some people who it's really emotionally resonant. You know, it's a historic event. This is something that we always considered to be an utter impossibility. And here we are doing it today. And hey, if we can conquer that, we can conquer anything. But then there's the other side where people are very angry about this. They want to know why the NFB isn't addressing things like the 70% unemployment rate, and they just sort of feel like there are way more important things that this organization could concentrate its time, funds, and effort on. For me, I feel like it's perhaps a little bit of both, but I think that this isn't just about the history that we've made with a blind person driving a car for the first time. For one thing, I think the technology and the study that goes into making this a possibility is also going to make its way into other areas. And I also think that it makes a wonderful public relations sort of thing, you know, not just because people are looking at, oh, hey, there's a blind person driving, who'd have thunk it? But because it's a chance for the general public to see a group of very successful, articulate, blind people speaking at an event and doing this challenge, and it really presents a very positive picture to people watching. It's not, oh, bless those poor blind people. It's, you know, wow, these people really have it together and they're doing something that's interesting to watch.
You know, interesting. I hadn't thought about that until you just said that, but the people complaining that they should be addressing the 70% unemployment, the reason there's such high unemployment is because people don't believe blind folks are capable. So when you show someone driving around this 3.5-mile racetrack, you're showing, wow, these capabilities are there. Look at all of us who may have unknowingly been given a chance at employment just because of people like Stevie Wonder and Ray Charles. I mean, there have to be people out there in the front lines proving capability. I know it shouldn't be that way. You know, in a perfect world, that wouldn't be an option and everybody would be judged on their own merits, but life doesn't work that way. Well, in the CSUN arena here, as we mentioned, we will be there, but Blind Bargains posted a very interesting topic talking about how to attend CSUN on a budget. And one of the big things that's coming up is that many people are staying at neighboring hotels to get the cost down from the $195 a night. Other tips in there included mentioning flying to LA and actually taking the train to San Diego to save costs, using the airport shuttle instead of the taxi cabs, which go every half hour.
Eating off-site from restaurants, because restaurant food is generally very expensive. The nice thing about the area that the conference is taking place in is that it's a very pedestrian-friendly place with lots of good food that's reasonably priced.
That's right, and I hope that many of you will meet up with us at the Tweet Up at CSUN this year. Although I didn't attend it last year, but we've got to do it. The good old Tweet Up, everybody yelling around in the big circle, hey, Michael Loft, Cyril Talk, yay, it's all good. But it's kind of neat to meet people. We've done some of those. I know, Ricky, you and I did at ACB and different events. And it's
yeah,
just,
that was fun.
It's just cool to put voices behind the people that you read their posts.
Absolutely.
Speaking of Twitter, I think this is a great article, and employment, all this stuff's all interwoven, but a great article was posted on how to use Twitter to find your next job, stating that many companies are using Twitter to find their next employees, and talks about following using a service called Tweet My Jobs. I wasn't aware of this service, but says they've listed over 1.5 million jobs in the last 30 days. Offers up-to-the-minute leads and gives some great tips, things like certainly be professional. And this one thing that I'm kind of guilty of is you got to be conversational, not just self-promoting and just pushing out your own wares and abilities and so forth. But the one thing that you see at Cyril Talk and these other entities, Blind Bargains, whatever, provide information and resources for both your readers and employers. In other words, make yourself an expert. All you have to do is link to the relevant good stuff that will be of interest to them, and it makes you look like an expert and someone that they want to have on their staff.
Yeah, it's a lot different than saying, hey, look at me, I'm interesting. Look, did you see how interesting I am? If you're actually posting things that really are of interest, you're going to gain followers, and some of them are going to be potential employers.
Another great tips include posting a professional photo, certainly the types of jobs that you're looking for. Understanding how Twitter works is very important. Linking to a website, and if you don't have one, talks about creating an account at LinkedIn, which I have not done. I know Mikey has. Have you, Ricky? I believe you said you have as well, right?
I have, although every time I log in, I get your LinkedIn profile is 33% complete. So I do have one, and I've got connections on it, but I've neglected it a bit in terms of actually including all of my information. I think it's a very valuable tool because you're able to not only show who is a part of your own professional network, but you can meet people who are a part of your friend's professional network. So there are connections that can be made that, you know, can't necessarily be made easily any other way.
And of course, the biggest success or failure with Twitter is following the right people. So obviously, when you're looking for work, you want to follow the leaders in your field, your potential employers, maybe college career centers, alumni offices, and more. So you can read more about that. And of course, using Twitter's advanced search features to find the job. And that's, I think, something a lot of people don't really know how to harness, you know, using the hashtags, the number sign in front of the keywords to make sure that your tweets are picked up by entities who aren't necessarily following you, but following those specific keywords, the hashtags. So a lot of good information available there.
That's right. While we're on the subject of social networking, there was rather an interesting drama within the last couple of days relating to Facebook, specifically the mobile Facebook site. When used in conjunction with Internet Explorer, Facebook made some changes, and the page was being presented. It was still very readable, but if you wanted to comment or you wanted to view more stories, that kind of thing, those links appeared as same page links, which just refreshed the page, but didn't allow you to actually perform the action that you wanted to. So a lot of folks contacted Facebook Accessibility and asked for that functionality back. It did return after about a day or so. So people are able to use Facebook Mobile in the same way that they always have once again. I actually got a response from a human at Facebook indicating that it was going to be fixed, and that I thought was a nice touch. I really expected a form letter. The interesting thing about this, though, is while we were able to make our voices heard and get the mobile site back to some semblance of accessibility for us, how long is this going to last? We really haven't concentrated any efforts on the main Facebook site. Facebook themselves have made some recent improvements, including doing a couple of ARIA landmarks, and they've always had headings so that you can navigate between posts and things like that. But the site is still considered not very usable by most blind people, and I think it would make sense for us as a community to advocate for full access to that site rather than depending on the mobile site, which could at any time stop supporting browsers other than mobile browsers.
Exactly. We must make it a priority to start advocating for full access to Facebook. It is too important. With 500 million users, be it tools for employment and communications, we have to make it a priority. We're going to have to organize and advocate in a big way for that. In the category of AT news, we've got a few things here. AT Guys is now offering refurbished, repaired Perkins Braille writers for $299. They include a one-year warranty. And of course, you can find out more about that over at atguys.com or get the link from CyrilTalk.com.
Those are actually the classic Perkins
Braille, by
the
way. Yes, the classic. I wouldn't have one of those new ones. That thing's a piece of junk. And again,
it
comments.
Feels very...
Comments are those of the individuals, and that's Michael Law. But I'm sorry, that new thing is a piece of, what was that, Dana Carvey?
You know, useless piece of plastic.
I've only had my hands on one briefly, but I don't know. It just looks like it could break very easily. I'd rather swing the giant classic, very heavy one that's all metal, and you can bash somebody's kneecaps in with that. That's what I want.
Yeah, I did in high school. I mean, I hit this girl on the kneecap, and I felt so bad about it.
Oh, no.
Man, she was, like, bent over and everything. Whoa. Colorado researchers are beginning a study for accessible appliances for people in particular with cognitive disabilities. The goal is to develop and design some guidelines for people of all ages, disabilities, and they're asking people to answer a telephone survey. Now, of course, if you are online or a caregiver, provider, you can fill out the thing online, but they're looking in particular for people who have issues with learning, memorization, and just organizational skills. So we have a phone number for that. If you'd like to participate in that, you can call 831-685-4798. But they are also interested in looking for people to join a new standards committee, and maybe some of our listeners would like to go that route. So if you're interested in cognitive technologies, by all means, you can call that number or get the link from serotalk.com and learn more about that. In screen reader news, NVDA 2011.1 Beta 2 has been released. Also in the beta front, WindowEye 7.5 Beta 1 has been released. And of course, we interviewed them at ATIA, and they said it will be coming out with remote access. However, this feature is not available in the beta. And my understanding is to use it, you will have to enter a 12-digit code. And so we have learned through our work, being the pioneer and innovators, and first in remote access, that sometimes getting a user to key in that 12-digit code is not the easiest thing, because sometimes you're using remote access for training purposes. So,
exactly. Sometimes users barely know where the space bar is, so this can be a challenge, but I certainly wish them luck for it. They also have support for the Internet Explorer 9 RC that's included in this beta, so go check it out if you like.
By the time you hear this, Liam Irvin should have released Super Egg Hunt 1.3. I don't know, you're more of a gamer than I. Have you played Egg Hunt? A lot of folks like that, Super Egg Hunt.
You know, I haven't played it, and not from any real lack of desire to do so. I just, it's one of those things that I haven't gotten around to. I did hear the sort of unauthorized sneak preview of it done by JJ of Blind Bargains. He did a little 60-second demo of it. Sounds like fun.
Yeah, so check that out over at L Works. Ricky, have you played with Google's new translation app for the iPhone?
I haven't yet.
Yeah, you can input 15 languages, output 23 languages with voice commands, or if you type in your text or phrases, you can go up to 57 different languages. And other than a few buttons, it actually works pretty well. Scott Rakowski was playing around with it and doing some translations from English, or as I call it, Australian, into Polish and some other, you know, and you learn, of course, with all of these things, you have to really articulate, because we as humans, other than Ricky, we as humans, we run our words together and stumble and stutter and stutter and stutter and all that crazy stuff. But it's a pretty cool app, and it is accessible other than a few unlabeled buttons. So give that a play if that's of interest to you. Now, I have to talk with someone like Mike Calvo, who's bilingual, or some of our users who are multilingual, to find out, because just because it gets the words right, is the meaning lost or misconstrued? So that's a whole thing you have to be careful of when you do language translations.
Yeah, exactly. You could end up with something rather embarrassing, or just something that didn't make sense or didn't get your point across. But I still think this is very cool. And apparently, you could just tap the microphone to begin speaking, so you don't actually have to click a button to begin the voice recording. Is that right?
Yeah. So we're going to come back and do
very
a demo
nice.
With that. And I'm going to get someone like Mikey, like I said, someone who actually knows the other language, so you don't just hear it and go, that sounds cool. Is it really accurate? That's the key. Especially, I think, of people speaking Spanish, because they speak so fast. I'd be curious to see how it holds up in that. Adobe has released Flash Player 10.2. What I like is we found a link. I mean, there's the typical installers, the little .exe files. Unfortunately, as many of you know, that's not the easiest thing to install. You've got the I button and the Q button. And
the Q button and the unlabeled button.
That's right.
And
so,
it's doable. I mean, there are plenty of people, well, what's so hard about pressing the I button? Nothing in particular, if you know what you're looking for, but some people don't. And I myself actually find it a little bit annoying. So I much prefer getting the accessible MSI. And we've got a link to that over in the show notes at saratalk.com.
That's right. So you've got those accessible MSI. And also Mac users should definitely upgrade, because apparently the new Flash saves much on battery life. There was real resource issues with the original one there. Well, it looks like Firefox is going to play catch up with Google Chrome, and they're going to put out four versions this year, 4, 5, 6, and 7. You know, Google,
wow.
Every podcast,
they went similar,
like
yeah.
6 to 10, you know, it's like, all you do is start making your betas new versions, or instead of 0.01 or 0.1, just start adding a number. Does it really matter to you? Do you believe a product is more developed because it's version 9 or 10 versus 3.0? I mean, I look at the quality of the product. I mean, the version numbers.
Yeah, I agree.
Some people go overboard with 1.916, and I just find that very interesting. There's this whole catch-up thing. Everyone's got to have the same version number. And of course, you can go see the specific set of features in each of the four versions over at Mozilla's Firefox 2011 roadmap. Again, link at serotalk.com.
Looks like Service Pack 1 for Windows 7 is coming on February 22nd.
Yeah, and also what may be equally interesting is the Windows Thin PC. This is going to be a thin version of Windows that you can install on older computers so you can upgrade some of those old XP boxes that by default are not Windows 7 compliant. So that's of interest to me, like how that might work on netbooks, or what the limitations of that thin PC software will offer. For our IT folks, there's a Windows Server 2008 R2 SP1, so it's supposed to really improve memory for folks playing around with Server 2008.
Well, even if you do get your operating system all nice and perfectly configured to work well on your hardware, what happens when you buy a new machine? As many of you know, it often comes with a bunch of stuff, bloatware, that nobody wants. So if you go and check out the article, which is an open letter to PC manufacturers saying, ditch the bloatware. You know, come on. People have been expecting this to decrease as time goes on. But if anything, it seems to be getting worse. These manufacturers are installing not only things like antivirus, anti-spyware programs that you haven't chosen yourself, but they're putting in toolbars on your browser that you might not care anything about. And the letter states, and I have to agree, that whenever somebody mentions company names like HP or Dell or Acer, you know, I automatically think, oh yes, the company that installs 26 different things that I have no desire for. And it's the letter is very interesting because it talks about why do you want to make a person's first out-of-box experience with a machine? You know, why do you want to make them spend that first 30 minutes to an hour just getting rid of crap they don't want?
And they will argue, well, it's to subsidize it. We can offer a lower cost because each company, Norton or McAfee, pays us a little bit, or, you know, Google to put the toolbar in there. But you're right, it does ruin the experience, and I can tell you, it really ruined Windows Vista.
Yeah.
It wasn't a great OS, but it was really impaired by all the crap that was installed on all the machines. And I had a Toshiba that never worked right until Windows 7 came out. Short of, you know, if you're a real geek, you just put your own clean version of Windows. You back up the drivers and go get a version of Windows. But, I mean, who's going to do that?
But many people aren't. And, you know, I think it's a problem that, yes, the companies believe, well, hey, we're able to lower the cost a bit because some of this stuff we're getting paid by manufacturers to include this. You're also damaging your brand, though. So I don't think they're really saving any money for the company in the long run if people just simply stop buying from the company. You know, they get somebody to custom build them a machine so that they can avoid this kind of thing, or they choose a company who doesn't include bloatware.
Here's a story I think's kind of big, the significance of this. Nokia actually switching from Symbian to go to Windows Phone 7. Their complete rival, nemesis, at one point. Of course, that was before you had Android and before you had iOS and Apple on the front with the iPhone. But this is pretty significant. I mean, not only moving their headquarters from Finland to Silicon Valley, you know, and then you don't even have any guarantees, this is some lip service right now, of maybe some accessibility in a future version of Windows Phone 7, but this is pretty significant.
Yeah, I agree. They're actually killing MeeGo, which was their OS that everybody hated. And they claim that they're still going to be encouraging people to use Symbian and develop things for Symbian and so on. And they probably will have some Symbian phones, but I don't think that they're going to concentrate their efforts on the higher-end handsets with Symbian. You know, you'll probably see the very cheap phones running Symbian, and they're going to be concentrating their major efforts on Windows Phone 7. To me, this is interesting. It has the potential to be a good thing. You know, right now, neither platform is accessible. MeeGo certainly wasn't, and Windows Phone 7 is not either. But I think Microsoft has a history that, while it does tend to ignore the blind population during the first couple of iterations of something, they eventually do get around to accessibility. And if they survive with or without Nokia in this space, I do think that we'll see some accessibility eventually. And I actually think that Microsoft may be a bit more committed to that than Nokia. So this could be a good partnership where, you know, now both companies really have to think about accessibility because of Microsoft's history in that regard.
Well, it's a great move for Microsoft because Nokia is, they're known for quality hardware.
Right. And Microsoft, I mean, Windows Phone 7, it's not dead yet, but nor did it really set the world on fire. And for them to partner with Nokia, who has a huge, rabid sort of cult following, you know, a lot of people are very loyal to Nokia. That's a nice move for them.
Well, we've talked in our last podcast, actually two ago, about the Kindle, or the Amazon PC application, making those 750,000 titles available. But we have the 3.1 of the Kindle software. No mention, really, of any improvements or addressing anything with accessibility. And many people are asking, what gives? What's going on here? So many people are taking it upon themselves to send an email to kindle-feedback@amazon.com. Ricky, were you one of those who has done that?
Oh, you betcha. I spent considerable time and effort writing a review of the accessibility features of the Amazon Kindle. And I did that partly because, you know, Saratech as a company wanted people to have a general idea of what accessibility was like on the platform. But I also did it because I felt like it was a great opportunity to actually give Amazon some really clear direction on where to go next. We didn't just say, hey, this isn't accessible enough. I provided some feedback along with the Saratok team as far as where this could go next. And there were several other people who reviewed the product and did a similar thing. And here we are with 3.1, and they haven't taken any of it seriously. So it was definitely a moment for me where I thought, hey, come on. You know, we didn't just say make it more accessible. We gave some pretty clear guidelines that weren't touched on at all. And that was very disappointing.
And I have to wonder if Amazon looks at, well, hey, we got Kindle for PC. If you want to do it, read it on the PC. And maybe they'll do a partnership with some other device and they want to get away from it. But no, that's unacceptable. You still want to put these devices in schools. We want, expect, and should be demanding full accessibility. Anything less is unacceptable.
Right on.
Yeah. Again, we remind you there is a great article with full help, including keyboard commands. And still the biggest thing that bugs me is that you have to make sure you get the right version. You have to have the one with the accessibility plugin. You know, you could be using it if you go and get the new one from filehippo.com, you break accessibility and you got to go back and get it from the right source. And that bothers me.
Yeah, that's annoying. The thing that bugs me the most is Tom and Samantha. I would much prefer Sappy 5 voices, but that's very much a user preference and not really an accessibility concern.
Yeah, and I still have to wonder if really all these 750,000 titles, I mean, some of those books are $50 a pop, so I guess we'll never really know, but I'd be curious if anyone's had any difficulty with particular books, and there's still some issues to be resolved, I guess, with table of contents and reading to end. And some folks say it doesn't work in certain books. So we'll have to see or make sure everyone has the latest version to accomplish that. But also Tech Access Daily has offered a demo on using the Kindle for PC.
That's Tech Access Weekly in their daily tips. So yeah, let's just combine it and say Tech Access Daily. I can't even say that.
You just did.
I think they use that term on the site. So again, Rodney and Aaron over there with a great podcast and a lot of good resources. Well, Amazon is expected to roll out their own service, just like Netflix with movie and TV shows, actually totaling about 5,000 titles. There was some text that showed up, which has since been removed, but it looks like users must either have the Amazon Prime, which is an annual service costing $79.
Worth it, by the way.
Yeah, and it gives you free 2-day shipping on any items that you buy from Amazon and very economical next day if you just got to have it right now. So that'll be interesting because, you know, now you have competition with Netflix. And again,
Everybody wants to jump on this bandwagon.
Yeah, you got to have good bandwidth. And believe me, Amazon does. A lot of companies couldn't pull this off. You have to have some really good bandwidth to move streaming video, but Amazon does. And as Mike Calvo and I have talked about, they've been the only service that has really not gone down since 1998 because they have such redundancy in place. So we'll let you know if that comes to pass. And that certainly would make getting the service more enticing. For the $79, you also get the shipping in addition to the video content. Well, I know some are waiting for it. Some are loathing it. It's the Apple news.
Dun, dun, dun.
Well, it looks like Apple wants a cut of the revenue generated from Amazon and Sony. And of course, they pulled the Sony app from the store, which has enraged quite a few folks. Of course, Sony devices have not been accessible, but just the same, it's a little disconcerting that Apple wants to make sure they get 30% from virtually everything. And some say they're making special rules as they go. And they're saying, no, we're not. We're just enforcing the rules that we already have on the books. What do you think about this? I mean,
well, I'm not surprised that Apple wants a cut of this because I think ebook sales are huge. And naturally, they're going to say, hey, we want more money. What they've done is to say that you cannot sell these books elsewhere and not offer a way for people to do in-app purchases from the iPhone app as well. So they're not saying that you have to purchase only from Apple, but you have to have the opportunity to do that if you want to have one of these reader apps on iOS devices.
Thanks for clarifying that.
And of course, Apple is banking on the idea that people are going to go for the convenience factor. Hey, I've just finished this book in a series on my iOS device, and I think I'd like to buy the next one. Oh, looky, I'm right here. I can just purchase it right through the app. Ain't that grand?
So we'll certainly see how that one plays out. It's got publishers in Europe quite upset about it, and a number of folks are very concerned about it. But you're right. I mean, that's just too big of an industry not to try to get a piece of the pie. Well, Ricky, you have just been on the serious advocacy bandwagon because also recently broken is the latest version of the Dropbox app for the Macintosh computer. They've broken accessibility and people are actually calling a number that I got from you from your Twitter post, 415-986-7057, and people are voicing their concerns because this app is written in the Cocoa language, so there's really no reason it shouldn't be accessible, and as you so eloquently put it, even the Windows users shouldn't be complacent because they could easily break our accessibility as well.
That's right. I did call this number and got a voicemail box where I left a detailed message about my concerns and unfortunately never received a call back. But I feel like, this is a big deal. A lot of people use Dropbox, whether it's on the Mac or Windows. And the issue is that Dropbox hasn't shown any commitment to accessibility on either platform. So I am concerned that, yes, they've broken the accessibility on the Mac platform and haven't shown any initiative as far as fixing that. But for Windows, I don't think they deliberately designed the app to be accessible. It's sort of accidentally so. And they could change that at any time unless we make them very aware of accessibility concerns and make that an actual part of their company policy as they move forward.
News Corp, and a lot of people know them as maybe the parent company for Fox, they've released their Daily. It's an app for the iPad. Unfortunately, it is inaccessible. And their goal is to really get people migrated from paying subscriptions for newspapers to paying online. And this costs 99 cents per week or $39.95 per year. And it offers news, also some stories and audio and video and so forth. And a lot of people made a good point. Well, big deal. You can get all this information from the web. So it is kind of a cool interface for those who can see and use it, but it is not accessible. And the BBC has released their iPlayer app, but A, it is only for the iPad, and as of now, it is only available in the UK. So hopefully, maybe by July, it'll be available in the US, and also maybe an iPhone version for it. One of the concerns is, and I'd be curious to hear from some of our listeners in the UK, because it was hoped that this would actually contain some described content that the BBC is offering that they might be able to listen to through the iPlayer. And of course, it was expressed that hopefully this app is more accessible than the BBC News app. And
you
can read more about that over at applevis.com.
Well, for those of you in love with Skype, or maybe you're not in love with it, but you have to use it for some things, the version 5.0 of Skype has been released for the Mac, so it's out of beta. It's got a few UI tweaks and so on. Also, on the Windows side, we have an article over at sarotalk.com detailing some tips for using Skype successfully with screen readers. Now, this particular article concentrates exclusively on JAWS, but there are some things that certainly apply to use of Skype with any screen reader. I also want to take this chance to mention Skype Talking, which is a nice little add-on for Skype that will tell you who's calling. It can read some chats for you and so on. So it's a really nice enhancement to Skype, regardless of what screen reader you're using.
Exactly. We did a demo, even though it was Skype 4, some of those commands are still important, or most of them, I think about all, really, about
how to
set it up for maximum accessibility. I agree, Skype Talking is also, it has some functions that aren't available in Skype, like bringing people into conference calls. And the Skype for the Mac just sounds awesome, and conference calling and the ability to dial numbers and bring people in, all working very well.
Perhaps it's because the Skype folks read the Apple's accessibility guidelines for developing Mac applications. Maybe they did, maybe they didn't, but this is a very nice link to have on hand when you're contacting developers on the Mac platform. And you just want something to point to say something more than, hey, this doesn't work. You want to give them a place to go and look and see how exactly they can improve this for accessibility.
Well, Ms. Advocacy, people are certainly encouraged to submit their feedback, as you have done, on the accessibility of Documents to Go Office Suite. What does this do, and why should we care?
This is for the iOS devices, and Documents to Go has been pretty much the most popular suite of applications to read Microsoft Office docs and so on. They have existed since the Palm days, and they're still the most popular, but they're also still completely inaccessible. I have been on a search to be able to read Microsoft Office documents on iOS devices, and I want to be able to edit them as well. And sadly, I have not found an accessible way to do that yet.
Well, by the time you hear this, Apple should have released iOS 4.3. So see what all cool new features are in there. And also latest iTunes has been released 10.12, which is going to be required for those who are owning or plan on getting the Verizon iPhone 4. And a great comparison was done between the quality of voice calls and data throughput by Peter Bosley, comparing AT&T and Verizon. And basically the synopsis is, from everyone that I've talked to, is that basically Verizon offers more reliable voice calls and slightly slower data speeds. So you can read that over at serotalk.com. Looks like Apple is relaxing their repair policies on products triggered with the liquid sensors, the LSI, because they were falsely being triggered in more humid climates, you know, places like Florida and just either other countries. So now more than one sensor must be triggered. Apple can't just claim just because one sensor says that, hey, you exposed this thing to liquid, we're not going to cover it. So kind of keeping a low profile on that, but that is good
news. You still
news.
Probably don't want to drop it in the pool, though.
No, you don't. Not a good thing to do. Well, Ricky, I want to ask you about this because we found this app for the Macintosh called Max, and it is basically an audio converter to switch between a variety of different audio formats. But what you have done is added a piece of software in conjunction with it to actually turn texts into audio files. So talk about that experience.
Yeah, this is actually quite cool. And I want to mention that some people aren't aware that in addition to the standard Mac voices, you can also get a cappella voices to be used on the Mac. So a cappella Ryan and Heather and some of the other voices, they have voices for several different languages. You can get those and they can switch to those voices just as easily as you would any other Mac voice. So what I've done, because I don't like the text-to-speech engine on my portable Daisy player, I've decided to convert books to MP3 using text-to-speech. I've got a program called Say It, and what you're able to do is just copy and paste the text. It can be even a huge amount of text. I think I copied a 900-page book in there, and you can convert that to MP3 using your default system voice settings, but it converts to either AIFF or AAC, and neither of those are playable on my portable device, so I then got Max to convert AIFF to MP3. Best of all, I never had to open any of these in iTunes. There are ways to convert these formats to MP3 within iTunes, but you also get that added to your library, which you might not necessarily want. But this is working beautifully for me.
Well, if you're looking for games for your iOS device, you can check out Chesswise, Checkerswise, and two other games. All accessible with voiceover, so we can give that a play. AT&T has announced that any mobile number plan, basically, you can call any other carrier via voice. So there are a few restrictions to that. So you can call any other mobile number instead of right now where it's just unlimited AT&T to AT&T minutes. You must have either national minutes or unlimited texting, and I think maybe one other option. So you have to have one of those to comply.
I think you have to have unlimited texting, and you also have to have had some sort of voice plan in place.
Wow, so I don't. So I have to pay $15 more for that because I just use a 200 text because I don't move that much. So,
yeah, I don't either.
And on AT&T, a lawsuit has been issued, a class action lawsuit with five different allegations basically saying that AT&T allegedly is charging people for more data than they actually use, anywhere from 7% to 14%. Some claims up to as much as 300%.
Ouch.
Yeah. They also allege phantom traffic use when no data was actually transferred. They allege they took a brand new iPhone, turned off push notification, disabled all location services, set up no email account, and closed all apps. And over 10 days, it still used 2.292 meg.
Yeah, I wonder what it was doing. You know, that may not sound like a whole lot, but if you're on a very limited data plan and you go over by just that 2.2 meg, you've just been popped for, what is it, $15?
That was exactly what this story was about, because it was a gentleman who paid 15 bucks for 200 meg and he ended up using 223 and he's saying, no, I didn't. And AT&T just tacked on little charges here, little charges there. They have responded and vehemently denying it and say that we take billing accuracy very seriously. So they're also claiming it's hard to prove because the dates and times of the usage are not recorded, making it difficult for people to dispute their charges. If indeed that is true, that would be a very contentious point. AT&T is also expected to expand their tethering plan to go up to 4 gig as opposed to 2 gig, and that will cost you $45. A lot of people think that's no big deal, but tethering certainly would be nice in cases those of us who travel go to CSUN, ATIA, and the blindness conventions. The ability to use tethering in that situation instead of having to pay $9 to $12 a night for hotel services.
Exactly.
And that's what's supposed to be in the iOS 4.3 is the can tether and do all kinds of cool stuff. The free Last.fm service apparently will be free no more for mobile devices. You will have to subscribe if you wish to continue to use this service.
Yeah, it's like $3 a month for a subscription. And a lot of people, you know, hey, what are you doing taking away this free thing? I want it back. I'm going to go to Pandora. Last.fm didn't want to use the same model as Pandora, which has, you know, you're limited to 40 hours a month on the free service and you get radio ads kind of in the midst of your music. And Last.fm said, no, no way. This is actually just for the mobile devices. Last.fm will remain free on the desktop version because that is ad supported and they're able to push ads just fine in that space, and they just found that it wasn't working well on mobile devices to do that.
Well, finally, because we went on and on and on and on and on, and you can also read more stories that we're not even going to cover here over at serotalk.com, but from the Apple rumor mill, there's an interesting article talking about what to expect from the iPhone 5, dual mode GSM and CDMA. Near-field communication, so you can pay all your bills and buy things by just waving your iPhone, however that's going to work, and some new improved hardware, maybe a 1 gig processor, so you can read more about that. And Apple is already including their next iPad. It's already in production, it would appear, and it's projected to have an announcement in March, maybe shipping as early as April, already with the near-field communication built into that. Front-facing camera, but unfortunately only 1 megapixel, so not going to be great for OCR, just as folks have found out by playing around with the latest iPod Touch. Here's probably the biggest story to me in Apple out of all of these, is that they've been granted a patent. What you'll do is you'll get your phone, and then they can show you which carriers are currently available in your market that can provide you service so that you as a consumer will have the choice, maybe even putting Apple or third-party carriers in a position to offer better pricing by basically buying blocks of minutes or data. Now, this is already done. You can already save money by going with third-party entities who either resell AT&T or Verizon and save people money. But this is big because Apple is actually getting into the space, or maybe you have, you know, a part of the country certainly that AT&T doesn't serve, or they could go with some smaller providers and maybe they cover 26 states, but not all 50 or certain countries, that you could actually get info from Apple. Here are your available choices based on your current location, and here are the prices, making Apple the middleman. So again, not only music and book content, but actually getting into making money from data plans and voice minutes. This is very interesting if this comes into fruition.
Agreed.
People wondering about iPhone 5. Looks like WWDC is set up for the Moscone Center on June 5th through the 9th. So probably look for an announcement in that time frame.
If you're not accustomed to going over to the show notes to check out additional stories that we may not talk about in detail here, I definitely suggest that you do so. We've got a whole lot of great stuff over there. Stuart Lawler has released the first in an ongoing series about Oratio on the BlackBerry. We have some awesome tips for shopping for food online. We all like that food, and having the ability to have that stuff delivered, whether it's perishable food or whether you're getting bulk stuff from Amazon to keep around and last you for a while. Got some great tips over there. David Woodbridge has released some tutorials for VoiceOver on the Mac. He previously did lots of them for the iPhone, and he's expanding that set for the Mac as well. So check out those and lots of other good stuff at serotalk.com.
Well, that's all we have for the news. But, you know, Ricky, you and I have talked before about guide horses. So it was very interesting to actually meet up with a lady who was very informative and felt compelled to explain and educate people on the costs and commitments of having a guide horse. And we're going to play that interview for you now.
Is everybody still awake?
Yeah, you're still awake.
If you're not, wake up now. We're talking about guide horses.
That's right. So, again, join us in 2 weeks. Other great tech chats every Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern. Make sure you have the latest iBlink radio, and you'll be set.
Thanks for listening. See you in a couple of weeks.
Live at ATI 2011, this is Michael Off. And I caught up with Cheryl here. We talk a lot on our podcast about ponies, and there was some concerns because some places were trying to outlaw them for health reasons or something to that effect, but just a lot of comments came up about how that works and what kind of unique housing arrangements and things you might have. So let's talk to you about this a little bit. Cheryl, how long have you had your pony there?
Actually, she's a miniature horse, and we technically call her a guide horse. I've had Confetti since she was 14 months old, and she will be 10 years old in May.
Wow, so you're definitely in the ninth year, it sounds like.
Right, and she's just hitting her stride.
Awesome. And so when you have a longer life expectancy, is that correct?
That's correct. I hope to get 35, 40 years for her lifespan, and I'm hoping that she'll work for at least 30 of that.
How does it work? I assume people either want to come up and pet her or something, just like the issues that, that dog owners have, but it is maybe a little bit different.
It's a lot of more, because basically everybody's heard of a dog guy, and they kind of know you're not supposed to pet a dog guy, but no, very few people have heard of guide horses. So the curiosity is, and the interest is definitely there. And because of that, we try to be very patient and informative and educate the public, let them in on it. And so far, the response is incredibly positive.
How did the training process go?
Well, that's quite a story. I originally went to Guide Horse Foundation. They didn't have any horses for me at the time. So they said, well, you're number 74 if you want a horse. You'll have to find your own trainer, get your own horse, and we'll provide the training details for you. So basically, that's what we did. It took a year to find a trainer that would even attempt to train a guide horse. They were all like, you're crazy. You can't train a horse to do that. You know, so it was very hard, and I was just about to give up completely when we found the trainer. So once we found the trainer, then the next step was to get a horse. So we sent an email out looking for a special mini, 26 inches or less, to be trained as a guide. And I got just a few responses back, but the best one was from where she came from, JBR Ranch in Christmas, Florida. And they said, she's everything you're looking for, only she is 27 inches high. So I went running around the house, what's an inch? What's an inch? So I made arrangements to go see her, fell in love with her, took a trainer with her, did the obedience, you know, the
field intelligence
test to see if she was viable to be trained as a guide. She passed with flying colors, so we negotiated with the owner to get her. And the stipulation in the contract was if she should not be fully trained at any time, that she would revert back to the ranch where she was bred. So about 3 months into it, I lost my trainer.
Oh.
She already had her basics. She knew her left, right, forward. And I lost my trainer, and I had so much time to find another one before I'd have to send her back.
So this wasn't a simple process. It's not there's not like a one school you can go to dogs.
It was not easy.
This takes a lot of initiative to get this going.
By the time I lost my first trainer, I was committed, both heart and soul, with this horse. And I thought if I sent her back to a barn situation, it would destroy her.
Right, because she was used to that.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the living arrangements.
She lived in our house. She has full access to us because we do not have another horse. And we are her companion. We're her herd. So she's very happy.
Because I've heard stories about people having to have special outbuildings. Like, I don't know if someone had an apartment, if they could legally challenge that.
The only outbuilding we have is where we store her hay.
Okay.
But you could use, I mean, it's like something you'd buy at Walmart or somewhere. You know, it's not elaborate.
Right, there's nothing that proprietary about it.
Right.
So let's talk about the cost for food. How much food might she eat in a month or whatever?
Well, I was curious about that myself when I first got her, so I did the math on it. And within $5, it's about the same as a dog.
Really?
Yeah.
And what does she primarily eat?
Hay, and we have a mineral substitute that we give her, that nutrients and supplements that a horse needs to be healthy. She goes to the dentist every 6 months, just like we do. And she goes and has her feet done, her nails trimmed, and she goes to the vet 4 times a year.
Do you have issues with discrimination going into certain facilities,
you know,
restaurants,
when
what have you?
When I first got the horse, I thought that was going to be a problem. But I'm relieved to report that she is overwhelmingly welcome wherever I go. As you can see by here, she's been very much welcome no matter where I go.
What about when you're traveling in a public facility like this? Her needs to relieve herself. I've heard something that they actually, by law, have to wear a diaper. Someone else told me that's not true. How does that work?
That's not true.
Okay.
I'm very responsible for her relieving. So I make it easier on myself and on her. I've invented a relief kit that I can carry with me, and at my convenience, I can relieve her, and I don't have to pick anything up. So it's actually, when I had my dog, I had to get on my hands and knees and look for it and scoop it, and, you know, that was not fun. This way, I can attach it to her. She relieves into it. I unclip it, tie it off, and throw it away. So, very easy.
Wow, that's really cool. You came up with this yourself?
I did. I invented it mainly because the very first guide horse made national news by having a poop accident on the plane. And I was going to be taking a plane that summer. And I said, that is not happening to me.
Well, that's a good point, because that's exactly the first thing I saw at the ACB convention in Jacksonville in 05 or 06, whatever it was. And a big relief on the second floor. And I thought, well, this is not good. Certainly this is not the norm. Any other comments? There's really no problems. It sounds like it's been a very good experience. You mentioned the foundation. Where is this located? Or how would people get in touch with them just to get the training if they have the motivation like yourself to go find the horse and the trainer?
Well, as far as I know, the Guide Horse Foundation is only interested in providing the training details. You can go online to guidehorsefoundation.com and get the training details, and any professional horse trainer can train a guide horse.
So
it's very expensive and very difficult to do.
That was my next question. What was the cost for the horse and to pay the trainer to spend the time?
I was very lucky. My horse trainer wanted a community service project. And so I was very lucky. But I've known people to spend thousands of dollars having a horse trained.
Wow, when you're talking about 30 years of service, that's really amazing.
Well, I'm looking forward to having many more years with her. With good care and good blessings, we'll grow old together. I call her my guide for life.
That is awesome. So I guess the only other thing I would ask you and your husband, Chris, here, if you've been attending the event, what, if anything, got your attention at this year's ATIA? Is there anything that you came particularly for? Any exciting news that you found out here?
Just the new technology, and I just saw that the OCR by Optelec that really impressed me.
Oh, the the
clear
device
viewer.
it looks like a little boombox.
Yeah. Very impressive.
Yeah, that was a cool little device, certainly. What about you, Chris? Anything?
I'm just loving it.
You just like tech? You like me?
I love tech. I'm techie, and I've been into computers since 1979, and programming and playing with and networking and bulletin boards and all of that stuff. And so I'm just, and my eyes are like so wide. I couldn't close my eyes if I wanted to.
The problem is always there's never, you know, not enough money to buy all the toys you see here, but
you've
it's really
got
cool
that
just to
right.
see what's
not
going on.
Not enough money and not enough time.
It's more for the dream list.
Exactly. So you local here to Orlando, or how
we
far did you travel?
We live in Jacksonville.
Jacksonville, okay. You've not dealt with any discrimination.
It's been amazing.
It's kind of a surprise to us, too, because we were expecting a lot of opposition, and we've got nothing but the opposite. I mean, we have been
welcome.
On a cruise ship, we've been on an airplane, we've been on a city bus, we've been paratransit, we've been to Disney World.
And they were teaching
we've
their people.
We've been to Cypress Gardens. I mean, just you name it. We've been.
They do world restaurants?
Oh, yeah.
Yes, Cracker Barrel is one of our favorites. We've been to several. We've been to luxury hotels. We've taken her to a rock concert. Tom Jones, the Four Seasons. We've done it all.
Wow, that's pretty cool. I think that's about all I have here for questions, but I certainly thank you for taking the time. Do you know how many other guide horse users there are in the U.S.? Any?
As far as I can tell, there are about 7 that
really?
I know of.
Right, that's the key, that you know of.
Right.
And are most of them in this area, or just kind of all scattered? Or?
They're scattered.
They're scattered, okay.
Yeah.
I want to thank both of you for taking time out to share this with our audience. This is really exciting. And I'm glad now that we actually have some reliable information to provide other than our opinions and thoughts of how things might work. It's been very informative.
Well,
thank you very much.
It's very important for you
here.
To get the real thing.
Exactly.
Because, you know, the NFB back in 2001 passed a resolution saying people shouldn't use horses as guides. But they based it on information that was not complete, and they based it on one organization. And because of that, you know, they said, no, people would be stupid to get a guide horse. But I think now, because we have actually been to NFB conventions with Confetti, they've seen her, and they love her. So, it's something that they jumped the gun on.
That's really important, because as guide dog users, you know, they can set the mood and say, I really don't feel like educating and training today, but you really have an obligation to spread the word. You really feel that you do anyway.
People that follow us to have a good example before.
Exactly. I thank both of you very much for taking time out of your busy schedule here.
It's been a pleasure.
Awesome. Thanks a lot. Live from ATIA 2011 in the very last interview before I go hit the airplane. This is Michael Law for the Cerro Talk blog and podcast.
You've been listening to Cerro Talk. Visit us at www.cerrotalk.com. Send us an email at resources@cerrotalk.com or leave us a voicemail at 866-997-BLAB-2522. We may read your email or play your voicemail in the next podcast. Join us in 2 weeks as we explore all the internet and life has to offer. Until then, may you have an accessible digital life.